Welcome to Understory, this 29th day of April 2020. I'm Elizabeth Poe. This week, Adrian Glamorgan and I are reflecting on some of the impacts of Chernobyl. Understory last week brought an interview Adrian had with Adam Higginbotham, author of Midnight in Chernobyl. An estimated 40% of the cesium-137 present in the reactor core has turned to aerosol, eventually depositing on the ground. For those spring days, phenomenal amounts of deadly radiation were spreading out across the Ukraine, across Belarus, across southwest Russia, to Leningrad, Scandinavia, to Western Europe.
Well, the truth is that the fires actually burned for 10 days. So, I mean, it's not as if there was this explosion and this immediate sort of puff of radioactive material came out of the top of the building and that was it. And those were the, you know, those were the circumstances that everybody had modeled previously. All remediation plans had been built around this idea. You just have one release of radiation and then that would be it. So this is part of the reason it was such a catastrophe. And so, you know, this radioactive cloud began billowing out of the top of the building on Saturday morning and then continued for 10 days and eventually encircled the entire northern hemisphere. So that's really about as bad as it can get. I mean, what the Soviet scientists feared was that when a meltdown in the reactor core began, they feared that the molten radioactive material was going to escape from the foundations of the building and make contact with the water table. And then their fears were twofold. One was that somehow this could cause a massive steam explosion as this super hot molten material made contact with water, which could potentially destroy not just what remained of the fourth reactor, but the other three reactors as well, and therefore form this kind of huge dirty bomb that would throw a massive, even more massive cloud of radioactive material into the atmosphere and therefore pollute an even vaster swathe of Europe. And the other one was that if this radioactive material reached the water table, which was not that far beneath the foundations of the building, then it would flow into the river Pripyat, which was the river that the power plant drew water from. And then the Pripyat is a tributary of the Dnieper River, which flows into the Black Sea. So the scientists were concerned that it would contaminate the drinking water for the vast part of Ukraine itself, and then the Black Sea beyond. So they really did have kind of catastrophic projections of what could happen.
Adam Higginbotham has reminded us that there was also a great deal of courage in the control room by the operators.
Once the Soviet authorities kind of got a handle on what their best propaganda line was on reporting about the accident, you know, they lionized the firefighters, but never mentioned the activities of the operators themselves. And this, you know, was a deliberate policy because they knew that further down the line, they were going to want to hold those guys responsible for what happened and blame the entire accident on the incompetence of these people with it, who were nuclear engineers within the plant. So despite the fact that actually the operators in the plant were not only just as heroic as the firefighters on the roof of the plant, but actually were exposed in far greater numbers with far greater awareness of the dangers that they were going into. You know, they were never mentioned in official reports in Pravda and Izvestia. And as a result, even to this day, like when you watch like a TV show about the Chernobyl accident, it still makes you think that the people who really bore the brunt of the suffering and the remediation were these men on the roof of the building, which is actually not true.
Since the 1980s, Joe Valentine has campaigned against nuclear power and nuclear weapons. In 1986, she was nuclear disarmament senator for Western Australia. Hearing of the Chernobyl accident was a chilling experience.
I remember exactly when I first heard about it, and I think I was in a funny little office in the old Parliament House, because that's where we were located. I was a senator in those days. And we heard it on the radio, and there were three of us in the room, and we all just froze because immediately we understood the ramifications. I can remember looking out into the little courtyard and thinking, oh, God, those poor people in that area will, you know, life will never be the same, and it hasn't been the same for them. And of course, we tried to talk about it in the Parliament, and at that stage there were mixed messages. It was a bit like the pandemic of coronavirus at first, when there were people not really taking it seriously, not really knowing what, how much to believe, a lot of mixed messaging coming out, especially from, as it was then, the Soviet government. They didn't really want to acknowledge it. So we got the news via Sweden and Norway, which were receiving these extraordinary radiation levels.
Yes, because they had, you know, further to what we were saying earlier about, you know, the nature of the nuclear industry worldwide. This is this reactor at Forsmark in Sweden, north of Stockholm. You know, they had two reactors there, and they'd been leaking previously, and they'd had, you know, some trouble with these new reactors that they'd been building. So when this guy set off the radiation alarm on his way into work that Monday morning, he naturally assumed that there was a leak from inside the plant. And it took them several hours to figure out that what had actually happened, because the Russians, the Soviet Union, had still not announced that they had an accident at this point. This accident happened late Friday night in the very early hours of Saturday morning. And these radiation alarms are going off in Forsmark at 8 o'clock on Monday morning. And so this was the first that the West learned of this. And, you know, he began setting off alarms and realized that what had happened is that he had walked radiation in from the parking lot outside Forsmark and into the plant from there.
When this is spewing probably the highest levels of cesium and all sorts of radiation out into the region, what sort of threat were people in the immediate locality facing, invisibly, unknowing, as this was taking place?
Well, as you say, I mean, there were many different kinds of extremely toxic substances spewing out of the top of the reactor, and all of them present different kinds of biological threat, depending on how close you are, and depending on how old you are, and depending on how long you spend in that area. Among the most significant in the initial phase was radioactive iodine, which lodges in the thyroid gland, and particularly in children. And it finds its way into the body through a number of different ways, but one of the most significant was that it could land on grass and then be eaten by cows, and then processed by the cows in their stomachs into milk. And then children would drink the fresh milk, which would be laced with iodine. And then they would be, their thyroids would take this up. And that was something that, you know, among the very kind of complex health effects of the accident, one of the clearest is the direct link between radiation emitted from the accident and thyroid cancer in children in the region, you know, hundreds of miles from the reactor.
Pripyat was ultimately evacuated and closed up. But what about the rest of the country, especially Belarus and Russia?
Yes, well, my friend Natalia, she had a young daughter, and I think she was 3 or 4 at the time. And whenever it rained, kids would like to go out and kick around in the puddles, as kids like to do everywhere. And they noticed that the puddles were a greeny colour, but the government hadn't told them anything about it. And on the 26th, this is just a few days before the May the 1st big military parades, it was like a national day in the Soviet Union. So the government didn't want those parades spoiled, so they weren't telling anybody anything. And these kids went out and played in the puddles that were greenish, and it wasn't until later that they realized that was contamination from the radiation which had hit their town. And so Natalia lived with this fear that her daughter would have absorbed radiation and would probably never be able to have children, and if she did, that they might be severely deformed and so on. So she lived with that fear. She had been a member of the Communist Party up to that point, and once they began to realise that their government had duped them, lied to them, not told them the truth, a lot of people left the Communist Party, which she did.
Novozibkov is an agricultural and light industrial city of about 50,000 people, about 160 kilometres east of Chernobyl. It remains the most contaminated town in the Russian Federation. The area, not suitable for human habitation, begins 1 kilometre west of the city boundary. That's where the cesium, strontium and plutonium is too high.
Well, it did. It changed their lives, and they were the most irradiated, still inhabited town in the Soviet Union. It was a town where the government saw that the clouds and the winds were taking the radiation towards Moscow. So they had a very difficult decision. Millions of people in Moscow. So unfortunately, the people nearer to the reactor, with the, when the clouds were still in that area, they decided to seed the clouds so the rain fell before it got to Moscow. So this must have been a very difficult decision for the government, but they knew that seeding clouds would produce rain away from the city. So the winds were taking the rain in a north-easterly direction towards Moscow. So it was forced to fall before it should have on these little towns in the southwest of Russia. So from then on, the people knew that they had extremely high levels of radiation. It meant that they couldn't go out of doors into the forest. They couldn't pick berries. They couldn't pick mushrooms. They couldn't grow vegetables in their own garden patches because it was a little town. So they did mostly live in separate houses with gardens, and they would have to test the levels of radiation with dosimeters on a daily basis. How would the children track their way to school? So they would carry these radiation monitors with them. So for years, our job through People for Nuclear Disarmament here in Perth was to raise money to send to them this group called Viola that Joanna also put us in touch with, which was monitoring radiation and which was educating people about how they should avoid the levels of high radiation. So each family had its own radiation detector, or two or three if they were lucky, so that they could carry them with them. And as soon as the levels went up and the monitors started beeping madly, they would just take a different pathway. So every day their lives were affected for a long time. I think that that has eased a little bit now, but they still have to be very careful about where they plant their tomatoes. In one corner of the garden, one year it'll be all right, and the next year the radiation will have settled there and they have to plant somewhere else. So the students who were going to the teachers' college in Novozibkov, they said, their supervisor said to them, if you want to go outside to eat your lunch, take your radiation monitor with you. Be careful where you sit in the grounds of their teachers' college. So it was very real and very immediate for them. And not being able to go out into the forest in summer to pick mushrooms and berries, it was just awful for them, awful. But before that, it was Joanna Macy, who with her husband, Fran, who spoke fluent Russian, who'd been in that little town of Novozibkov, I think only 4 or 5 years after the accident. And it was from those workshops where they were trying to help people to psychologically come to terms with what was happening to them, what had happened and what was still happening, because the radiation doesn't just evaporate, it doesn't just go away. So they had got onto this idea of doing the elm dance at their workshop. And the people in Novozibkov loved it so much. They were in tears every time they danced it. And they said to Joanna, when you're doing your workshops, will you please tell people our story and will you please do this dance? So ever since 1990, I think it was, Joanna did that. So whenever I was at a workshop with Joanna, we did this dance. So we kind of had that connection through her with the people, but I'd never met anybody from there until these two people came and joined our pilgrimage in 1997.
Karman Klajas, was originally a song of a cultural resistance movement against Soviet occupation. But deep ecology workshops held by Joanna and Fran Macy in Novozibkov led to choreography, and thus we have the Elm Dance. Many people experience the Elm Dance as emotionally powerful. For the people of Novozibkov, it meant facing their disposability compared to the citizens of Moscow. It was facing the fact that for centuries into the future, there is no post-Chernobyl. For the time being, they must face the damage being done. It is the grief of people who can no longer interact with the environment. The atom has been split, and in Novozibkov, the atom separates humanity from nature. You've been listening to part two of our series commemorating the 26th of April 1986 nuclear disaster at Chernobyl. The music excerpt was from Ieva Akuratere, sung in Latvia, Kā man klažas. Thanks to Adrian's interviews with author Adam Higginbotham and anti-nuke campaigner Joe Valentine. I'm Elizabeth Poe, and thank you for joining us. Also thanks to the RTRFM 92.1 team keeping independent community radio live and alive in a time of coronavirus. Listen in next week when there'll be more to explore with Understory, radio for the planet.